Well, it is a fact that that all the time, Earth is bombarded with stuff that comes from space. Most of the time, we're talking about small objects, and most of them burn up in the atmosphere and they never even reach the Earth. Occasionally, something comes that's big enough so that a piece of it may get to the Earth, but the damage that was caused, that would be caused, would be relatively small. We do, however, know that something like 65 million years ago, something very big hit the Earth, and the consequences, at least for the creatures who were living on the Earth at the time, were pretty catastrophic. Now, I don't think that we're expecting that something like that's going to happen again anytime soon. However, we cannot say that such a thing is impossible. Now there are scientists and astronomers and others who are saying that, you know, it would be a good idea if we made sure that we tried to chart and identify all of those objects that are out there that we think might come close, so that we would have something of a heads up if a significantly sized thing would ever come close to the Earth and have the possibility of hitting it ever again. And this morning we'll be talking with a scientist from NASA who was about 10 years ago, I think, was one of the people who said, this is an important effort, we should be doing it, and we should organize such a project. And indeed, it has happened. Our guest is David Morrison. He is a senior scientist with NASA's Astrobiology Institute. And he is here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. We'll give a public talk sponsored by the folks at the Department of Astronomy on the topic Cosmic Collisions, How Astronomers Are Saving the World. That's this afternoon at 4 in the Follinger Auditorium on the U of I campus. And I'm sure anyone who would like to attend should feel welcome. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. He grew up in Danville, went to school here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, where he studied physics, went on to get a doctorate in astronomy from Harvard University. Before he went to work at NASA, he was professor of astronomy at the University of Hawaii. He was the director of astrobiology and space research at the NASA Ames Research Center, where he managed basic and applied research programs in the space, life, and Earth sciences, and has written a lot of papers on the subject of astronomy, and more than a dozen books. And we're pleased that he could be here with us this morning. And of course, as we talk, as always, if people have questions, they should feel welcome. And I know he would give his best a shot at answering a question. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much.
Good morning, David. It's good to be here.
I appreciate it. So, as I understand it, maybe it was about 10 years ago or so, you were one of a group of people who were saying, particularly we're trying to raise this issue and saying to government, saying, this is something that we ought to organize a project to look out in space for the express purpose of identifying objects that were in orbits that would bring them close to the Earth, particularly things that were a significant size, so that if they did hit the Earth, it would be a problem. Right?
I was thinking, when you were giving that really splendid summary as an introduction, that if you'd been doing that 10 years ago, people might have thought you were a little flaky, because hardly anyone then realized that the Earth is orbiting in a kind of swarm of asteroids, a cosmic shooting gallery, and that they do hit our planet. We know that in a very simple way by looking at our neighbor, the Moon, which is covered with craters. Every one of those craters is the result of an impact. There are 30,000 craters visible even in a small telescope. The Earth has had the same experience, except geology tends to wipe away the craters almost as fast as they're formed.
Mm. And we do have an atmosphere that provides a little bit of protection, in that when stuff comes through the atmosphere, it's going to encounter friction and it's going to burn up. And we're talking about just something that's little, it's not going to get through the atmosphere and it's not going to get to the Earth.
That's right. The atmosphere does a fine job of protecting us from the small things. But the big ones, the kind that form sizable craters, the sort that we worry about in terms of a hazard, punch right through the atmosphere like a fist through a cobweb.
This thing that we believe was the object that did in the dinosaurs these tens of millions of years ago, what's the estimate of how big that was?
The size of it can be estimated both from the crater it left, which is in the Yucatan in Mexico, and from the amount of extraterrestrial material like the metal iridium that it deposited on Earth. And it was about 10 miles or 15 kilometers across.
Mm. And as far as we know, we feel with some certainty that that's the biggest thing that has ever hit the Earth.
No, it's the biggest thing that's at all well documented. Because we have found the crater, because it did produce a so-called mass extinction, in which not only the dinosaurs all went extinct, but most species on Earth did, including the mammals, our ancestors. And so it's quite clear what happened there. As you go back in time, there's less and less evidence. There certainly have been many other craters. We know, in fact, early in the Earth, it had a lot of impacts.
Well, how big would something have to be? See, here we're talking about this was 10 miles. How big would something have to be for it to do serious damage, something that would, for example, affect the climate on a global scale?
That's the perfect question to ask. It's the same question the scientists have been asking for these last 10 years, because we want to know, what is the greatest contemporary hazard to us? What are the chances that we'll say on your tombstone, died from an asteroid? or what kind of disaster is it that we're most concerned about? And it's from a asteroid, quite small, about a mile in diameter, which would be large enough, however, to excavate a crater, throw lots of fine dust into the stratosphere, and lead to what's sometimes called an impact winter, like a nuclear winter. So there would be a drop in temperature and crops would be lost. Earth would recover fine in a year or two, but just think about what happens if there's a worldwide loss of crops. If everything goes for one growing season, it would be pretty unpleasant. I could imagine 1 billion people starving to death. And I'm not sure those who were left would be good friends either. It's an experiment we don't want to ever do.
We don't want to do that one. So then when you're talking about the possibility of something smaller, you could be experiencing localized damage, and it could kill people, it could do a lot of destruction. But then when you're getting down smaller than that, then you wouldn't have a global kind of effect.
That's exactly right. The Tunguska impact that happened in Siberia in 1908 is an example of one that was as big as a large nuclear bomb, 15 megatons. If it landed on a city, it would destroy it. Millions of people could die. But if it lands out in the farmland somewhere, or the desert, or in this case, the wilderness of Siberia, no real harm done. Big explosion, but it only affects those people and structures and things that are near ground zero.
So your thought, and I know the thought of other people, was we know that objects of this size and potential destructive ability are out there, and that there are some things that are in orbits that are going to bring them close to the Earth, at least. And so what we ought to do is we should catalog these things so we can keep track of them. Right?
That's right. We want to know whether an impact will take place. The probabilities are very low. It's hundreds of thousands or millions of years between an impact. But that isn't really what counts. We want to know if it's going to happen. If you were crossing a busy intersection, you wouldn't want to know the statistics of what the chances are of pedestrians being run down. You'd just look. Is there a car or a truck headed for you? And the same philosophy applies here. We want to find out definitively by finding these objects one at a time, calculating their orbits. If it's safe, we check it off. No problem. If against the odds we find one that's going to hit us, then we'll have decades of warning, and probably we could even do something about it.
Yeah. Before this effort started, this project, this very specific project to map these things, how many objects were at that time were known that were indeed were in these orbits that would bring them close to the Earth?
Near Earth asteroids, there were fewer than 100 known when we started. There are now more than 1,500 known, including about 700 of those a kilometer or larger in diameter that could conceivably produce a global catastrophe. So we have found more than half of them, and we're trying to find 90% by 2008.
So how did if at the beginning there were only a percentage of these known, how did you go about estimating how many you thought there were altogether?
When we started, we really didn't have a very good idea. Now we do, and the principle is actually pretty simple. If you start a survey and look for the first time, every asteroid you find will be new. As the survey nears completion, a larger and larger fraction of those you discover will be rediscoveries because it's an automated system. So now today we are rediscovering more than we're finding new. So we're past the halfway point. And at any point in the survey, you can thereby estimate what the total number is left to find.
Based upon how many you've spot one and say, okay, well, no, we've already got that. And that's number 2, 3, 4, 7, 8,
right,
or whichever it is. Okay.
Right.
Let me again introduce our guest. We're talking with David Morrison. He's a senior scientist with the NASA Astrobiology Institute and is visiting campus here to talk about this very topic, that is the effort to identify, to chart those objects that are out in space that have the potential, at least, the possibility of hitting the Earth. And if we're talking about something big, that would be very serious, and we would want to have as much notice as possible so that then we could start thinking about what we might try to do about it to avoid that kind of collision.
We call this the Space Guard Survey, and it is saving the Earth, in a sense. About once a day, the telescopes, or once a night, I should say, discover another one of these asteroids, check it off as safe. So every day you're just a little bit safer from being hit by an unknown asteroid coming out of nowhere with zero warning.
Well, you mentioned the fact that if 10 years ago I had introduced the subject as I had and said, you know, there's this possibility that the Earth could be hit, could be very bad, we should be aware of that, and we should have as much notice as possible. You said people might think that one would be a little crazy.
I would hate to say that about you.
No,
of course.
Nobody would say that about me. But you did, in fact, you gave testimony before Congress, and were trying to make sure that you know, they understood that this was important and it ought to have some money behind it. At the time, how were you received by the members of Congress? Did they think that you were a little nutty, or did they sit up and take notice and say, well, yes, maybe this is something we should pay attention to?
Well, when I first testified before Congress, I did have in my hand the result of a NASA study that I had been in charge of. So it began to be a little bit respectable. It had the NASA imprimatur on it. But they, I think, thought it was still just a little weird. I remember one of the congressmen saying after, he says, you seem like perfectly nice, intelligent man, and you seem to be seriously worried about this. Does it bother you that the Congress is very unlikely to give you any money to do it?
And what did you say?
I'm not sure what I said, but ultimately they did give us just a little money. Mm. It's not very much. It's carved out of the NASA budget, but it's enough to carry out the survey.
Right. So how much are we spending on this effort?
NASA is spending about $3 million per year. And the U.S. Air Force is contributing the telescopes that are being used. And then there's an international component who are doing some of the orbit calculations. And I have to mention, one of the best things is free. There are amateur astronomers with their own telescopes contributing their time who follow up on these discoveries. The automated telescopes find the asteroids, but it's the follow-up observations by amateurs that let us tie down the orbit. Yeah. And so they're a key part of saving the world, if you will.
Well, that's interesting, because certainly I know that that amateurs are responsible for, have been responsible for identifying a lot of comets. Because what it takes is a lot of patient and dogged observation to find something, that you just have to spend a lot of time looking through the telescope to find them. Is that with the case of asteroids, is it essentially the same sorts of thing? It's just a very sort of slow and dogged and deliberate matter of just looking for those things.
It's certainly slow and dogged, and in fact, it's not the amateurs who are finding them, because it takes very sophisticated automated telescopes. They're not that big, but without today's computing power, for instance, there's no way that we could find them. So the professional telescopes with the big computers pick out the little moving asteroid against a background of millions of stars. Then that information is posted on the web, and the amateurs then follow up.
Mm-hmm. So everything is moving. How do you manage to sort out those objects that you're interested in from everything else?
Everything's moving, but not at the same speed. And for all practical purposes, the background of stars is fixed. The Earth, of course, is turning. Mm-hmm. So if you take one wide-angle picture, you could have millions of star images, and perhaps there'd be one asteroid, indistinguishable in a single picture. Take another picture half an hour later and compare them, however, and you can see the moving point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess that the next natural question that I'm sure a lot of people would have was, if indeed we would, well, let me ask this question. Once we get these things charted out, how much in, if there was something that was, its orbit would intersect with the orbit of the Earth, how much warning might we expect to have about that potential collision?
That's a very good question. And of course, we generalize, understand there could always, against all odds, be an exception that was coming right toward us today. But generally, if an asteroid is going to hit the Earth, it will come by over and over and over again, hundreds, thousands of times. So you pick it up on some earlier pass. We expect many decades of warning. That's the expectation you would have.
Would, if we just had a brush, would that have any sort of effect on the Earth? If it was, we're talking about something short of an actual collision, if it would just whoosh, just went right by, would we notice that?
Not really, any more than you would notice a bullet going past you that missed you. There might be a little bit of a sound as it whipped past, but you don't care. It's the one that hits mm-hmm. you that matters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to make sure that people who are listening know that, again, there's the opportunity to call in and ask questions. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for local folks. We do also have that toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you might be hearing us. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll free 800-222-WILL. I guess people might be a little bit confused or wondering if, because you said that we could have an object that before, if it's going to hit the Earth, before hitting the Earth, it could have passed by close a number of times so that we might have seen it go by a few times before it got to the point where...
Yeah, that's the idea with the Space Guard survey. Pick it up on one of those early, benign, mm-hmm. close passes.
So why would it not just continue to follow that same orbit and forever just pass by?
It will continue to follow its orbit, and the Earth will continue to follow its orbit, but if it actually is in an Earth-crossing trajectory, eventually they're both going to be in the same place at the same time. Uh-huh. And then that's bad news.
Uh-huh. And that is the kind of thing that can be predicted, at least with a few decades worth of time.
Yes, or even a few centuries. It's only in Hollywood that asteroids capriciously change orbit, and you know the astronomer says, "Oh my God, it just changed in orbit; it's headed for Earth." That's not the real way it works.
And it's not possible that we should be able to again, as we say, we should be able to chart all of these things and know it's not likely that one day we just might wake up and suddenly there would be something heading toward us that we'd never seen before. We hadn't had it charted. It wasn't on our map. We'd have to say, this is a completely new object. We never knew anything about this before.
Well, we hope that won't happen, but it's certainly something you cannot absolutely guarantee. Mm-hmm. That's why our objective is phrased in terms of getting 90% of them by 2008, because you never know when you have 100%, frankly. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to reduce the odds, just like insurance would or any program. We're trying to make you more safe, but I cannot guarantee that you will be absolutely safe.
Mm-hmm. Probably as people think about, play out in their mind scenarios about what one might do if an object like this was headed toward the Earth, and probably our imaginations are informed by what we see in the movies and on television. I guess the first thing that people think of is, well, what you could do is essentially blow it up. We could take a rocket and we could put a nuclear device on that rocket and we could shoot that rocket toward the asteroid and we could blow it up and that would take care of the problem. But it seems that in fact, no, that might, when you think about all the things that one might do, such thing would actually make the problem worse because you suddenly might find yourself not just with one big object, but you could find yourself with a number of still pretty big objects and, you could have as bad a problem as, or I don't know, maybe even worse problem than if we were just talking about one big thing.
That's it, right. You've converted a bullet into a shotgun blast.
Exactly. Good metaphor. Yeah.
But what you really want to do is change the orbit. You want it to not hit the Earth. Possibly, if you blew it up far enough in advance, the fragments would disperse and miss the Earth. Mm-hmm. But most of the thought today is about keeping it together in one piece and pushing it or somehow altering its orbit. just a little bit. And it doesn't have to be much. The Earth moves its own diameter along its orbit in about 6 minutes. So if it's going to hit the Earth, say, 82 years from now, all you have to do is change its orbit enough so the asteroid arrives 6 minutes early or 6 minutes late, and it will miss. Now, that's great in principle. If you ask me, do we actually have the technology to do it, I'd have to say no. There's an interesting article in Scientific American this month talking about just that. Could we develop, with our current rockets and our current technology, a system that would move an asteroid, that would change an asteroid orbit appreciably?
Hmm. And are there people who are thinking about that?
They're thinking about it, but, you know, you usually look for the money, and there is zero money being spent on it. Hmm. It's people thinking about it in their spare time. Right. It's not an actual government program to start developing the technology.
Right. So presumably, if we came to the point where you could go to Congress and you could say, 30 years from now, and maybe then they could say, oh, well, we don't have to worry about that until, you know, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, we could start thinking about it then.
It's a very abstract danger now. If we ever actually find something headed for Earth, the whole picture will change. Mm-hmm. And I think there will be lots of incentive to develop the technology, to use international cooperation, to do whatever it takes to save the planet.
Right. We have three callers here ready to go. Let me just mention again real quick that our guest, David Morrison, will be speaking about this very topic on the U of I campus today in the Follinger Auditorium. That's the one that's on the opposite end of the quad from the Union. And he'll be speaking at 4 o'clock this afternoon. It is open to anybody who would like to attend. It's sponsored by the Department of Astronomy. And if you're interested in hearing more on the subject, you should stop by there. We have some folks here with questions, and we'll start with someone in Urbana and line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'll just ask you two questions and then hang up and listen. The first question is, between the two approaches, if we ever do have to deal with an asteroid, the nuclear bomb approach and then the tweaking the orbits, the asteroid's orbit approach, what kind of thinking is there on which of those is more feasible? And my other question would be, politically speaking, given that the standard procedure is usually that nothing gets done until after there's a disaster, what's the chances for actions being taken to avoid something like that before it occurs? So I'll hang up and listen.
All right, thank you for the call.
Well, those are good questions. On the first one about the preferred approach, I think if we could move an asteroid, change its orbit, that would clearly be the best thing. Throwing a nuclear weapon at it and trying to blow it up and all is kind of, maybe that's the, if you really only had a few years warning, perhaps that's all you could do. But we think we could build a rocket engine, for instance, an ion drive, that could achieve a change in orbit. We already know we have spacecraft to get to such an asteroid. A few years ago, we sent a spacecraft to the near-Earth asteroid Eros, that orbited it and even landed on the surface. So, in principle, it sounds good, but, you know, the devil will be in the details. Mm-hmm. You're right about it taking a wake-up call to make people do anything. I'm delighted that we're able to get the money we are for this space guard survey. But I think, actually, we don't have to have a collision. I think if we found something on a collision course and could put the pictures in the newspaper and say, there it is, that arrow's pointing to it, that thing is going to hit us in whatever it is, 76 years or something, and we'd know the date and we'd know the time to within the minute, I think it would be real enough to get some results.
Mm-hmm. And just if you were thinking about not the blow-it-up strategy, but the nudge-it strategy, and that the idea would be, I suppose, to launch some sort of spacecraft from the Earth to this thing, get it landed on the surface, and then, I guess as I'm imagining it, you would have a big rocket engine. You would fire your engine off, and that way you would do your nudging here.
Simple physics, Newton's third law.
How far away from the Earth would it be the optimum place to do that if you're balancing the fact that you'd want it, presumably you'd want it to as far away as possible, but that, you know, there you also, for the amount of time it would take the spacecraft to get there, your ability in real time to send commands, if this is automated, maybe
remember,
you don't want to be too far
away. What we want to do is change its orbit. Yeah. And the longer in advance we start, the less we have to push to get that change.
Okay.
So probably many of these approaches, like an ion drive, would operate for years. And it would be, remember, it's still going by the Earth over and over, but cumulative thing. It's also not necessarily only one try. You could use different technologies. If you had this decades of warning, if the first one fails, you can try something else. You have lots of time. Time is what we're buying with the Space Card Survey.
Mm-hmm. To Champagne, the next person in line number two. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. You mentioned something about the Yucatan Peninsula being the site of the asteroid that hit the Earth and destroyed much of life as it existed then. I'd always heard prior to the last few years that Iceland was also a candidate for that source of the iridium, et cetera. What is the status on the origin of Iceland? Was it an asteroid or is it just some geological fluke?
I don't know of any particular issue about Iceland. It's a very volcanic area right on the Mid-Atlantic Rift that's opening. You can see in parts of the rift going right through the center of the island. It's very much a product of internal geological actions on Earth, whereas the impact 65 million years ago that made what we call the Chicxulub crater in the Yucatan is one of those rare but still important external effects on the Earth.
Yeah. Originally, I had in several magazines read that Iceland was thought to have been a meteor or asteroid coming down, causing the rise in the molten crust up through the solid crust. But that's fine. You've answered my question. Thank you.
All right. Let's go to line three and another caller. This is Savoy. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
The question I have, you may have answered already, I'm not sure, I just joined not long ago. But basically, and I think this is sort of a detail, you know, the devil's in the details as you just said, but I'm curious if where an asteroid might hit the Earth would sort of determine its effect on the Earth, and not talking about, you know, rural versus urban, but if it were to hit, for example, in the middle of an ocean, I understand that the momentum transfer would be the same. But would that momentum be dissipated more effectively by water than it would be by the Earth, the solid Earth?
You're certainly right. You're certainly right. The effect in the ocean would be different, at least for small ones, because most of the energy would go into producing a tsunami wave,
Okay. Which
actually can go further from the point of impact. It's a pretty efficient way of transferring the impact energy to large distances. So if you live right on the coast, you might want to worry about tsunami. When you get to really big ones, like the 10-mile asteroid of 65 million years ago, then it really doesn't matter. It will punch right through to the crust. It'll punch through ocean. It'll punch through the surface. If so much energy is deposited, the explosion is so tremendous that little superficial things like whether there's an ocean there or not hardly matters.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Would such a thing have a permanent effect on the orbit of the Earth?
No. It's in fact, there's an interesting exercise. Take a globe of the Earth and look at where that Chicxulub crater is. Mm-hmm. On a standard 10 or 12-inch globe, it's just a quarter of an inch across. Little tiny crater. It has no effect on the Earth as a whole. It doesn't affect the orbit, the spin, the magnetic field, anything. The real breakthrough, in my opinion, that the Alvarezes and their colleagues did when they discovered that the mass extinction 65 million years ago was due to an impact, is that an impact that is so small on the cosmic scale of things, so small in geological terms, can nevertheless really screw up the atmosphere and produce an ecological calamity.
Next caller is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, enjoying this. Isn't the breakdown of meteors supposed to be not only on size, but also whether they're rocky versus metallic?
Sure. And in the case, for instance, where we're trying to figure out which ones will make it through the atmosphere, that does make a difference. A stone comes through better than a comet made of ice, for instance. But when it's really big, it's just the total kinetic energy that comes in. If I shot you with a bullet, it wouldn't much matter if it's made of stone or ice or steel or what or silver or whatever. If it's a big enough bullet, it'll kill you. And it's the same way here. It's the energy ultimately that matters for the big impacts.
Okay, but I guess the density of the meteor would have a big impact on any kind of plans of diverting it, say.
Right, right.
So I'm just thinking, how do you, from a distance and on a short time scale, how do you tell how dense something like a meteor would be?
Really hard. And in that sense, the scenario David painted a while ago is a little simplistic, that we would just send up the defense spacecraft. Mm-hmm. We would first send up scientifically instrumented spacecraft to measure all those things, its density, its internal structure, its composition, its shape, its spin. You'd want to know a lot about it in order to plan the details of your deflection strategy, if that's what you're doing.
Yeah, and when you're, I've heard that it would have to be at no closer in than the orbit of Jupiter. I've heard somebody say recently, but what they didn't explain is how is it that you're able to gauge the trajectory of incoming meteors at all at that distance? Those little tiny objects, you know, relatively speaking, how do you do that?
Well, you're asking all the hard questions here. When you talk about seeing it for the first time coming inside the orbit of Jupiter, you're really talking about comets, the long-period comets, which are not easy to deal with at all. Everything I've said about Space Guard survey and developing a catalog refers to the asteroids, the rocky metallic asteroids in the inner solar system that come close to the Earth. Comets coming from nowhere, single pass, none of those philosophies applies. I would say there would be a major question whether you would ever even be able to determine, once you discovered it, whether it was going to hit or just come close. I don't know how to deal with comets. The good news, though, is that they're only 1% of the problem. We're hit 100 times by an asteroid for every comet that hits.
But, okay, well, I guess I didn't realize he was talking about that. So the asteroids come from an inner belt. And,
right.
And you are able to tell where they're going to go pretty closely?
Yeah, it's really neat. The you know, it goes back to Newton's mechanics, but it's gotten a lot more sophisticated, and there are big computer programs. There's one at the University of Pisa and one at JPL that take into account the gravitational perturbations of all the other planets and asteroids, and they can predict very precisely for a century or so. You don't do so well at predicting what will happen 1,000 years from now.
Okay, but okay. So you're assuming, or you're talking about asteroids that you know pretty well.
And once you find it, you have to follow up, and the minimum is probably a couple of months of observation. A
couple of months,
and then the next time, 2 or 3 years later, when it comes around and observed again, when you get it there, you now have enough leverage to really tie down the orbit.
Okay, one last question. I think I read recently that that sometime in the recent past, someone actually saw the creation of a crater on the moon. Is that true?
No. That was an interesting story that speculated that. Well, there's actually several interesting stories. One is that some monks in England nearly 1,000 years ago reported something that's sometimes been interpreted as an impact, although really the description doesn't fit it. So I can't say it's never happened and no one's ever seen it. Statistically, you don't expect it, and there's certainly no good evidence that any of the craters on the moon is as young as human civilization on Earth.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll go next to Homewood up near Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Well, that just leads up to my question. Has anybody considered using the moon as a shield?
Well, you know, a shield has to, you have to be able to maneuver a shield to be between you and the incoming projectile. And it's a lot easier to maneuver the projectile than to think about swinging the moon around anywhere.
Well,
the moon's also pretty far from the Earth. So it and Earth co-inhabit the same part of space, but neither one protects the other.
I was just thinking of nudging the asteroid to hit the moon instead of the Earth. That's what I was.
Yeah, you could do that, but that takes a lot more energy than just nudging it a little bit so it misses the Earth.
And what about a close call? I guess we've had some recently.
We have a lot of stories in the newspapers. Think about the process. The astronomers are discovering these every day. And they got a few days' worth of observations. They calculate a very preliminary orbit. You don't really know where it's going to be because you don't have enough observations, enough data. And sometimes those orbits will indicate in a formal calculation sense something like a 1 in a million chance that it will hit the Earth. Just highly uncertain. Well, we have a few reporters around who, on a slow news day, go to the internet and look these up, and there you see a story in the newspaper, astronomers find asteroid on collision course with Earth. It gets a little tiresome after a while. If they would wait a few days until the orbit converges and is more precise, then if it were still on a collision course with Earth, you'd have a good story. But it never turned out that way yet.
Okay, well, I'm just recalling that, I don't know, it's within the last several years that I've heard that there's been several of them that have come by, I guess, come in the neighborhood.
Well, that's true, too. Not that they were predicted as an impact.
No.
And that's just an indication that the astronomers are doing their job. Those guys were coming by the Earth all along, and we didn't know about it.
Mm.
And now we're finding them. And the more we find, the more cases there are. We say, oh, my goodness, it came as close as the moon, or we only found it 3 days after it passed the Earth. Whatever the particular news story is, fact is we're out there looking and finding them.
Is it because we're looking, or is it the technology, or both?
Well, it's both. We could not carry out this survey with the technology of 15 years ago.
Really? Okay.
And so it uses the new technology, but it also it's just real time, and real people and real telescopes discovering real asteroids, not just waving their arms.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Well, in this time now that we have actually been doing this, what's the closest that something has come that we have seen?
There have been a handful that have come as close as the moon. I maybe one half the distance to the moon. It's a good wide miss in cosmic terms. And as we said earlier, a near miss really doesn't do anything except maybe make a newspaper story. It either hits or it doesn't. If it hits, we're in trouble. If it misses, so what?
Okay. On to another caller. Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hi, I'm enjoying your program. I've got a brief question for your guest. Somewhere within the recent past, that meaning somewhere between 30 and 45 years, I seem to vaguely remember a report where there was an unexplained darkening at more or less high noon along the East Coast and caused a good deal of momentary excitement. And I had completely forgotten about it until Garrison Keillor mentioned it on his Writer's Almanac. Has there ever been any explanation of that event, and might it, in fact, have been one of the close-crossing asteroids? I'll hang up and let you answer as best you can.
Okay.
You won't get much from me because I have never heard of this, and I don't really know what you're referring to. I had a check with Garrison Keillor's book, but... I really don't know what you're talking about there.
Okay, well, other questions are welcome, and I know our guest will take his best shot at answering your question, and we're talking with David Morrison. He is a senior scientist with the NASA Astrobiology Institute, and we have been talking here about the effort that's been going on now for a number of years to chart, to identify those objects in space that have orbits that could intersect with the orbit of the Earth, and if they were big enough, that could be a problem. The idea is here astronomers are saying that we should identify these things, we should chart them, we should keep an eye on them, and so if there is the possibility of something hitting the Earth, we want to have as much notice as possible. So that's what we're talking about. And again, I also want to mention that our guest will be giving a talk on this very subject on the U of I campus this afternoon at 4 at Follinger Auditorium. So if you'd like to hear more, you can stop by. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455.
David, let me mention one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about the asteroid impacts that are large enough to produce this global catastrophe,
mm-hmm.
where you will suffer whether it hits here or on the other side of the Earth. Now, there are a lot more smaller impacts. They're still infrequent, but things like that Tunguska blast in 1908. And one of the questions that is being discussed now, the scientific community is looking at, I'm sure the Congress will be, is should we go ahead and search for the smaller ones as well? It costs more because they're little. Takes bigger telescopes. And the actual danger is less. You're more at risk from the global catastrophe than the local one. But it's still very real. And so how much is it worth? How much should the government spend to protect us from these things? Is it like the other government programs? Think of all the money that's spent on highway safety or on aircraft safety or protecting us against unusual diseases and so on. Should this one be up there too? Should we have a major program to protect the Earth from even small impacts?
And whose decision is that?
It's certainly the decision of the Congress and the administration in the case of the U.S. That's another one, of course. Is it the U.S.'s choice? This is an international problem, but the U.S. is the only superpower, and we sometimes take it upon ourselves to try to deal with the world's problems without too much consultation with allies. Is this a case where we should just go ahead and do it or wait for the international community to catch up? Mm. I don't know the answers.
We have some other people with questions. Maybe you have the answers for them. Next person is on the campus, line number one.
Perhaps you've already answered this, but I was curious about how you got started in your science career. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. I know you. I mentioned at the beginning of the program you studied physics here at the University of Illinois.
Right. But I was interested in astronomy from the time I was in grade school. In fact, I remember in the eighth grade I sold my electric train to buy my first telescope. So I guess it's been a natural. A lot of young people are interested in things like astronomy. Most of them outgrow it. I didn't. And so I'm having a great time and very pleased to be a scientist.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you to talk about was about astrobiology. I mentioned a couple of times that you work at the NASA Astrobiology Institute, and apparently you have been very important in defining and organizing and in actually making this a field of study. What is astrobiology?
Astrobiology, it's the study of the living universe, of life in the universe. Its origin, distribution, destiny. Of course, the only life we have found so far is here on Earth. So a lot of it is to look at the origin and evolution of life on Earth, how it interacts with the planet, but ultimately so that we can search for life elsewhere, so we can carry out the right experiments with spacecraft on Mars or Jupiter's satellite Europa. Now that we're discovering planets around other stars, we want to be able to identify habitable worlds around other stars and ultimately find out if there's life there. We want to ask the fundamental questions about life itself. What is it? What's the real definition? Does it have to be put together with carbon atoms and water like us, or could it be other things? So it's inherently multidisciplinary. It's a real challenge to get scientists from biology, geology, astronomy, and so forth to talk to each other and put their heads together to answer some of these questions.
Mm. Let's talk with someone in Robinson, Illinois, line number four. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering, you said something about, like, you can spot them 70 years in the future. Would you go ahead and try to do something about it because perhaps future generations would not have the ability to do something about it?
Well, I hope that future generations will be smarter than we are, and that if it's really a long way out, you know, we shouldn't do too much. We should let them. But even 70 years or 50 or whatever, I think we'd start the program right now. I think we'd do the first steps. We'd send a scientific spacecraft. We'd investigate it up close. We'd make absolutely sure we understood the orbit. And we'd start doing the long-range technology leads for actually developing a system to deflect it.
Well, I you know, like our ability to go to the moon, you know, we seem to have flawed some, you know.
Yeah, right. Tell me about it. Used to be, you know, 20 years ago, one of the common statements was, hey, a country that can go to the moon can do, and then you fill in your whatever you want, some wonderful grand project. We no longer are a country that can go to the moon.
I just wondered if that was a consideration. Thank you.
All right. And we have somebody here on cell phone, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment, and it relates to basically the policy of the government and the American people towards science. The first is that we're in a situation and have been for a long time, which is very much like the tourist who goes to a foreign third world country and throws a lot of coins on the floor and watches everybody scramble and fight to get those coins. So what we have is a situation where science is extremely underfunded, and we have different groups of scientists, high energy physicists and biologists, and all they do is fight amongst themselves for a small piece of a pie, because basically we don't have any input into how big a piece of the pie we should be getting. So we end up squabbling amongst ourselves, which is exactly what the government wants. I think also what we're seeing is that Americans, and particularly my generation, as we get older, we turn away from space research, which never should have been funded on the basis of all of the good technological information we got that made life better for people. And now they're all going into biomaterials and the biological sciences because all the yuppies, basically, which includes me, want to live forever. And so I think that in America there is a fundamental anti-intellectual and definitely not interested in science attitude. And I think unless we can deal with that, and I don't know how we can deal with that, we're basically going to not be able to justify what we do and get funding for what we do.
You know, I'm sorry, you're so cynical about the government and so concerned. That what you say, of course, is absolutely true. There is a lot of anti-intellectual and anti-scientific thinking. But in spite of that, the U.S. government puts more money into basic research than any other place in the world. We do have a space program, a great space science program. We spend a lot of money on medical research. And the squabbling among scientists is the way we pick the best things. You'd want to spend that money wisely. And so you have lots of competitive ideas, and you peer review, you have panels, you compare them, you argue in the public forum. And ultimately, I hope that means the money is spent for the best, highest priority program.
We are going to have to stop because we've used our time. For people who are here again in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can hear more from our guest. He'll be speaking this afternoon at 4 in the Folinger Auditorium on the U of I campus. His visit here is sponsored by the Department of Astronomy. David Morrison, senior scientist with the NASA Astrobiology Institute. Thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.